Tortoise. Hello, I'm Claudia, and you're listening to the Slow Newscast from Tortoise. This is episode 3 of our 3-part series, Putin's Murders. Over to my colleague Giles.
Meet Odessa Ray.
Alexei was really one of the most extraordinary people I have ever known.
She's a film producer who had a stroke of luck during COVID. She was making a documentary series for Netflix on Alexei Navalny, the anti-corruption campaigner and opposition leader, and was filming with him in a rented chalet in Germany when the pandemic hit.
And I feel so privileged that I got to spend this very quiet time with him in the Black Forest. Alexei never spends this much time with anyone. Like, he's usually, you know, you have 15 minutes for a meeting and you da-da-da, but we were stuck in this sort of bubble.
So thanks to lockdown, Odessa Ray got to know Navalny well. And this was at a time when he was making the most important decision of his life, whether to go back to Russia once he'd recovered from an FSB attempt to poison him in 2020. He wore his anxiety lightly.
It was terribly serious, his decision to go back and the day that he went back and the days leading up to going back. But before that, he would joke, "Well, Odessa, if they kill me when I land, will your movie make more money?" And I was just like, "Alexei, like, stop. This is like too dark of a joke."
I'm Giles Whittell, and this is the Slow Newscast from Tortoise. Putin's Murders, Episode 3. The Fall of Stalin. Navalny did go back.
There was no sense of self-preservation that he had, which is, I think, a very Russian thing that doesn't really exist in the West. Like, in the West, we more think about our lives and how we want to live for ourselves. And there was not really any of that for Alexei. It was what can he, as like a tiny cog in the huge machine, do to change the machine for the better?
Did he think he would die?
No, definitely not. You know, Alexei, you can see from the documentary, is someone who's very optimistic. He believed in this, he called it the beautiful Russia of the future that he wanted to build. And at the time, also it was before the Ukrainian war broke out, and people didn't really know how far was Putin actually going to go.
Looking back on Alexei Navalny's decision, you'd have to say his optimism ruled his mind, because the alternatives are not plausible, that he was hopelessly naive or that he hadn't been paying attention. He had been paying attention. What he hoped, Odessa says, or what he allowed himself to hope as a way of managing fear, was that having been poisoned and survived, he might escape further attention from the authorities because of the negative press that it would attract.
He thought, okay, maybe they'll put me in prison for a year, maybe 3, maybe not at all. I think he actually thought quite likely not at all. They would just let him go about doing his thing, you know? And if it's a year, if it's 3 years, he thought, I can face that. Like, time is on my side.
For years now, Navalny has been spoken of mainly as a campaigner. And he was that. While filming with Odessa Ray, he was also putting the finishing touches to a film of his own.
This is not only an investigation, but also, in a sense, a psychological portrait. I really want to understand how an ordinary Soviet officer turned into a madman who's obsessed with money and luxury and literally ready to destroy the country and kill for the sake of his chests of gold.
It was a feature-length documentary about Putin's palace on the Black Sea, a billion-dollar 21st century Versailles meets Mar-a-Lago, complete with aquadisco and, Navalny said, a boudoir for pole dancing. But Navalny also wanted to be president, to run Russia. His political rallies attracted tens of thousands of supporters. Who jails people so that Putin can steal, he says. Putin, they reply. Navalny backed himself to build that beautiful Russia he always talked about. Early in his career, in fact, he was an unashamed nationalist. He tried to run against Putin in 2018, and, like Lenin, who returned to Moscow from exile to lead the Bolshevik Revolution, he understood the fundamentals of the trade.
he said to me, I'm a Russian politician. Like, you cannot, for Russia, you cannot sit in Germany and be a Russian politician. They have zero interest in listening to you, telling them what they should do and feel from sitting in Germany or the US or wherever it is.
So Navalny challenged Putin's power and accused him very publicly of running a kleptocracy. And even the most casual look at history tells you those are two extremely effective ways of getting under Putin's skin. His film on Putin's palace has been viewed more than 100 million times. He had a genuine popular following, says Misha Glenny, the author of McMafia.
And indeed, Navalny was a key reason, along with his determination to prosecute a war against Ukraine, for persuading Putin to go the full Stalin, as it were.
On January the 17th, 2021, Navalny returned to Russia. A crowd of supporters and journalists applauded as he boarded the plane in Berlin. At Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport, he paused to speak to them.
Здесь мой дом, я приехал сюда, и я приезжаю, меня все спрашивают, боишься, не боишься? Я не боюсь.
This is my home, he says. I have come here and people are asking, are you afraid? I'm not afraid. Navalny goes on, I will go to passport control with an absolutely normal feeling. I'll come out the other side and go home because I know I'm in the right. He was detained at once. Over the next 2 years, he was sentenced to 3.5 years, and then an extra 9, and then an extra 19, on a variety of bogus charges, including, in the end, inciting extremism and rehabilitating Nazi ideology. He was frequently thrown in solitary confinement. Last December, his lawyers lost contact with him for 6 days, while he was transferred to Arctic labor camp IK3, also known as Polar Wolf, run by a warden named Vadim Kalinin. Former inmates of IK3 have told Medusa, the independent Russian news site, that Kalinin is a maniac who presides over a regime of legalized torture. Even so, when contact with Navalny was re-established late last year, Odessa Ray allowed herself to hope.
I think it's because, you know, it had been 3 years since he was in prison, and they hadn't killed him yet. I think I was more nervous of that scenario in the first few months, the first 6 months maybe.
She hoped he might be allowed to serve out his time or be freed in a prisoner swap. Then Putin lashed out on the Costa Blanca, of all places.
A man who was shot dead in Spain last week is believed to be a Russian helicopter pilot who defected to Ukraine last year.
Maxim Kuzminov, a Russian army captain, had made a deal with Ukrainian intelligence. He would fly his attack helicopter into Ukraine from Russia and hand it over in return for protection for him and his parents and $500,000. It all went according to plan, until he moved under an assumed name to Villajoyosa in Spain, on the coast a short drive north of Alicante. In a sense, he was among friends there. It's a town with a big expat Russian community, but Ukraine couldn't vouch for his safety. On February the 13th, he was shot multiple times in the underground car park of his apartment building and then run over with his own car. It is worth pausing on the attribution question here. Who killed Maxim Kuzminov, really? Is it possible to say Putin? Or is that lazy? Spanish police haven't released the results of their investigation, and it's quite possible the hit was outsourced to local Russian organized crime. But remember Vladimir Milov, the former energy minister, on Putin's extreme micromanagement.
He really inserts his nose into everything.
And this would necessarily be an international incident, like the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko in London, and the attempted poisoning in 2018 of Sergei Skripal, the former Russian spy who retired to Salisbury. In the case of Maxim Kuzminov, it's hard to imagine Putin not being given, at the very least, a heads up. The other question is, what was the point? And the answer is housekeeping, says Boris Bondarev, the former Russian diplomat who has, shall we say, a bone-dry take on world affairs.
I think that was done mostly to prevent other pilots from deserting with the helicopters, because helicopters are now not things that Russia can dispose of easily. So every helicopter is a precious thing. So of course, so they declared that they would find him and kill him. Just right away, after he deserted, just to send a signal to all others who would be defectors.
It seems to have worked. There haven't been many defectors since Kuzminov, although it has to be said, there weren't many before him either.
Because everything changed with Navalny's comeback.
Vladimir Milov is talking here about the domestic Russian scene rather than the battlefield. But the zeitgeist, the numb compliance at all levels of Russian society and endeavour is similar.
Putin had already made a decision for a full-blown crackdown on any dissent, lengthy prison terms, murders, and so on.
Yulia Latinina, the journalist who fell foul of Yevgeny Prigozhin and his bucket of human excrement, says that by February this year, Putin wanted to broadcast a message to the world about his war. What he wants, she says,
is to show to the West that all the red lines are gone, that he doesn't care about red lines, and that he's winning, that he rolled over Avdiivka.
Avdiivka is the latest town to be flattened in eastern Ukraine.
He's continuing to roll, that Russian army is on the rise, that all the mistakes he's done 2 years ago when he tried to conquer with insufficient forces, that he's ready to play further, that nobody can stop him.
I mean, since February 2022, we've gone from, I would say, an authoritarian state to one which is beginning to look totalitarian, so maybe a sort of half-totalitarian state. And totalitarian states, well, the secret's in the name. You can do whatever you want.
A few more murders couldn't do any more damage to Putin's international image, Misha Glenny says. And in fact, Vladimir Milov believes Putin had especially high hopes of the next murder on his list. Milov is talking here about Putin and his inner circle of securocrats and their ancient mission, inherited from the KGB, to execute Red Terror.
So first, they have no limits in terms of physical violence and what they do in this regard. Second, their fundamental thinking is that, people are okay in living in intimidation and fear under strongman rule if they are given some 10,000 rubles, I mean, to satisfy their daily needs, and they are threatened with prison if they speak out in dissent, right? They think that all this, drive and demand towards freedom, rule of law, this is just an invention of some Western liberal circles, and we can really go back to medieval times and move to a world where strong men rule through intimidation and bribery. And he thinks that the problem is that there exists, 50 people, 100 people, as you said, traitors, who stir the situation. And they genuinely believe that they can solve all their problems if they just remove these 50 people.
This isn't new, Milov points out. It's a belief that most dictators have in common. And it was certainly the philosophy of Russia's Tsarist secret police under the Romanovs.
You just need to isolate and remove a handful of dissenters, and you'll have flat calm in the society for another several hundred years. This is their philosophy. So when they kill the next one and things do not calm down, they do not think that this is because they usurp the power and oppress the people and people want freedom. They think it's because there are some traitors still left who continue to stir the situation, so we need to go after them. It's a perpetual search for this just one button which you can press to shut all the dissent down. they tried this button, the movement did not cease to exist and continues. They look for another button.
Odessa Ray was boarding a plane in Dubai when she got the news.
I was heading to my gate, and as I was walking to the gate, I was talking to Christo Grozev, who's at the Munich Security Conference. And he was telling me that we had an agreement, that all parties had agreed to this swap and that it was going to happen. I was so overjoyed. Like, I actually remember picturing that, wow, we might see Alexei soon.
Christo Grozev is a former Bellingcat journalist who'd been closely involved in trying to free Navalny. The prisoner swap never happened.
And I got in, like, the bus to take you to the plane, and I didn't look at my phone for good 20 minutes while, like, boarding and getting on the bus. And then I got on the plane, I sat down in my seat, and I looked at my plane and my phone, and it was just, like, being bombarded with messages. Like, and I saw, sorry for your loss, sorry for, what a tragedy. Like, these messages just coming in, thousands of them. I mean, like, thousand of them, just one after the other. And I was just like, what's going on?
Around midday London time on Friday the 16th of February, Russia's Federal Prison Service issued a statement saying that Alexei Navalny had felt unwell after a walk at penal colony IK3 and had almost immediately lost consciousness. All necessary resuscitation measures were taken, the statement said, but they did not yield positive results. The time of death was given as 2:17 p.m. The following day, Novaya Gazeta, the newspaper of Anna Politkovskaya, reported that bruises were seen on Navalny's head and chest before his body was removed. The report was never confirmed. Also unconfirmed, a story that an FSB team arrived at IK3 from Moscow 2 days before Navalny's death and disabled all the prison's CCTV cameras. Vladimir Milov and Bill Browder both believe Navalny was simply given a fatal injection.
I think that they held him down, injected him with some compound, and killed him. And I think they did it deliberately before the election to scare any possible opposition so that Putin could announce this insane 87% electoral, quote, victory.
Why the injection theory?
This is how they do things. They just, if you want to get rid of somebody, you know, you don't want to beat him to a pulp because that then is visible.
Milov says that Navalny was already wary of prison medics with syringes.
We knew that it happened before. So I think something similar probably happened now. And all the circumstances of extreme gradual isolation point out that Putin was preparing for this.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.
There are about three times more political prisoners in Russian jails today than there were at the end of the Soviet Union. It sounds callous, but you have to ask, who's next in Putin's crosshairs? In Vladimir Milov's formulation, who's the next button the Putin machine will press? Yulia Latynina isn't sure she wants to talk about it.
We are discussing things that are, you know, so really scary. The whole situation is unimaginable. We are discussing, you know, whether the people in the Kremlin would kill a man who is completely defenseless, who is sitting in their prison. And it just beggars belief that we are discussing it.
And yet, we are. And no one is really in any doubt about who's next. His name is Vladimir Kara-Murza, and he's a dual Russian-British citizen who helped Bill Browder lobby the US Congress to pass the Magnitsky Act in memory of the lawyer Sergei Magnitsky. The Magnitsky Act provides for personal sanctions, including travel bans and asset freezes, against any government officials Congress deems complicit in human rights abuses anywhere in the world. Putin hates it.
As a result of our joint efforts, both of us have been targeted, you know, very aggressively by Putin. In my case, they've issued death threats, kidnapping threats, Interpol arrest warrants. They sentenced me to 18 years in absentia in a Russian prison. And in Vladimir's case, since they had easier access to him because he refused to stay away from Russia, they tried to kill him. They tried to kill him with some type of chemical nerve agent in 2015.
Vladimir Karamurza suffered multiple organ failure after that attack and nearly died.
They tried to kill him again in 2017 after he barely survived. He continues to feel the after effects of both those poisoning attempts very profoundly. And then when the war started in 2022, he said he was going back to Russia to protest the war. And all of his friends, including me, I had dinner with him 3 nights before he went back. I begged him, and so did everybody else, not to go back. And he said, how can I not go back? How can I ask people to stand up against Putin if I'm afraid to do it myself? And so he went back. He went on CNN. He called Putin a war criminal and a murderer. And he was arrested a few hours later, and he's now sitting in a solitary confinement in Siberia, serving out a 25-year sentence for treason.
Vladimir Karamurza's prison is in Omsk on the Trans-Siberian Railway, only marginally less remote than Navalny's.
I think that it's a near certainty that he will die if we don't get him out soon.
The problem with that is that Karamurza has a British passport, and the UK has a public position of not negotiating for hostages. I ask if in fact there aren't grounds for hope, because unlike Navalny, Karamurza is not a household name.
It's very important to understand what the purpose of all this is. I mean, part of it is very personal. It's like, you have to imagine that Putin is in a prison yard. He's a small guy in a prison yard. He shows up first day, and everyone's looking at him and laughing at him. And he takes out a shank out of his sock and goes to the biggest guy in the prison yard and just stabs him repeatedly in front of everybody, blood spurting everywhere. And then he looks around and says, who's next? And so everybody's sort of scared of Putin, and they respect him, and they don't touch him. But if somebody shows up in a prison yard and shows disrespect, and all of a sudden, you know, the boss of the prison yard gets shanked himself.
Bill Browder's prison yard analysis is based on the idea that Putin and his circle have stolen so much money, that they have so many enemies, that he must stay in power, however many murders it takes, simply so that they can all survive. That, Browder says, is the nature and extent of Putin's paranoia. And over the years, he's used three shadow armies to enforce its dictates: the Chechens, the Wagner Group, and of course, the all-conquering FSB. So is Putin, in the end, the little runt with the shank in the prison yard, or a czar in the image of Ivan the Terrible, borne along into an uncertain future by a giant killing machine? The trouble is, he could be both. I know, it's not a satisfying answer. But here's the thing. It's an answer that would fit quite neatly into a strange dark hole in history, left by one of the earliest casualties of Putin's long pursuit of power. Remember Anatoly Sobchak, mayor of St. Petersburg in the 1990s, Putin's mentor, who some say was his first victim? Well, Sobchak's widow, Lyudmila Narusova, says that she has saved the results of the independent autopsy that she paid for on her husband's body in the year 2000. Saved them in a locked box outside Russia, not to be disturbed until after her death. In the meantime, she is a lifetime member of the Federation Council, Russia's upper parliamentary chamber. And Putin makes a point of treating her with elaborate courtesy, almost as if there's something on his conscience.
Mm-hmm.
This episode was reported by me, Giles Whittell. The producers were Matt Russell and Emmy Harper. The sound design was by Dominic DeLaghi with artwork by John Hill. The editor was Jasper Corbett.
Tortoise. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.